We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is Friday night, September 12, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We are live every Friday night, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. If you're listening to us on Saturday on the Dark Matter Radio Network, now you know. Listen to the show live on Friday nights at 11 o'clock p.m. What a show we've got for you tonight. I got tons of interesting articles here, including some articles on some topics we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks. If you have been listening to us as we have discussed things like mystery cell phone towers, the supposed Bigfoot arm that was found in Florida. We've got follow-ups on those stories on the show tonight. Then, in about a half hour, we are going to be joined tonight by Lauren Coleman, a legend in the field of cryptozoology. Lauren has been following this subject and reporting on it since 1960. He has written a number of books on this topic. He has covered everything from the Loch Ness Monster to Bigfoot. He is still blogging today. He is the man behind the International Cryptozoology Museum, which I believe Time Magazine listed as one of the 10 weirdest museums in the United States. Very excited to have Lauren Coleman on the show tonight. That's coming up in about a half hour. Until then, it is going to be news. It is going to be emails. It is going to be open line phone calls. Anything that is on your mind. A couple of notes here. I'd like to direct everybody to a few websites, the most important of which is AfterDarkRadioShow.com. This is the place to go for everything you need about this program. If you need the phone numbers for the show, they are at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you need a link to our Facebook, which my buddy Andrew is constantly updating with new stories and photographs and all sorts of interesting things, that link is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you're looking for the Twitter handle, a ongoing Twitter feed, in fact, that is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can follow me at Brian Alvarez. And if you missed last week's show, which was featuring Marie D. Jones, author of 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomenon, if you go up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now, you can download that show absolutely free. The show will be available for free until we go off the air, at which point this show is going to be replacing that one for the next week. So you always have 1 week to download the show for free, and you can always do so at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Obviously, if you're listening to this and you are a subscriber to my main website, WrestlingObserver.com, you can jump in and have full access to the After Dark archives. Every show that we've ever done is available there in the archives to subscribers at WrestlingObserver.com. So head up and check out the show with Marie D. Jones. A really, really excellent show. We didn't just talk the 1111 phenomenon, but we talked about everything. So head up there and check that out. The phone numbers for the show, if you'd like to give us a call tonight, it is toll-free, 855-478-4478. Once again, that is toll-free, 855-478-4478. If you cannot get through with that number, You have east and west of the Rockies options. If you are west of the Rocky Mountains, you can call 425-488-0525. If you are east of the Rockies, you are welcome to call 425-482-1686. And given the fact that this show is taking place very late at night, I will let you in on a little secret. No matter where you are welcome to call any of the lines. However you can get through on the show, go ahead and get through on the show. I just gave them interesting names here, stealing blatantly from Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM with East and West of the Rockies. We do have three phone numbers, though. So you should have little problem getting through. 855-478-4478 is toll-free. 425-488-0525 or 425-482-1686. Phone lines are open right now, so give us a call. If you'd like to email me, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com. That is B-R-Y-A-N at WrestlingObserver, all one word, .com. And make sure you put After Dark in the subject line to make sure that it gets to me. I've got a lot of emails to read tonight. And if you email this show, I can pretty much guarantee that your email is going to be read on the air tonight. I will be monitoring Twitter as well. You're welcome to contact me there with anything that is on your mind. And as always, if you are a longtime listener to Coast to Coast AM, particularly Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell, you know how it works. You are welcome to call on any topic under the sun. If you are interested in any of the topics we've talked about in the last couple of days, if you'd want to talk about Bigfoot or anything like that, you're welcome to give us a call. So, again, if you miss any of the numbers, afterdarkradioshow.com. By the way, Dave on Twitter here says, for After Dark, you should do a show or mention the random cow mutilations that have been going on across the country. Dave, if you are listening to this right now, if you've got any links to any articles about this, please send them to me. I'm very aware of cattle mutilations. In fact, we've had Linda Moulton Howe, who has been studying cattle mutilations, I think, since the 70s. Maybe for sure the 80s and 90s, obviously. But she has been on the program talking about cattle mutilations, so the story's been around for a long time. If there has been a rash of new cattle mutilations, I would be very interested in hearing about that. So drop me a line if you are listening to this and direct me towards where this new information is at. And also a big shout out to Scotty here, who says he is ready to be spooked on the show tonight. I don't know if it'll necessarily be spooky when we talk to Lauren, because we're going to be talking a lot about cryptozoology, which is the search for unknown animals. And we'll be talking a lot about some unknown animals. Sometimes when people hear about cryptozoology, they just presume, well, you know, these people are looking for Bigfoot. They're looking for the Loch Ness Monster. These people never find anything. What I don't think people understand necessarily is that, in fact, there have been prehistoric animals thought to be extinct for millions of years that have turned up in our lifetime, including one, which we will talk about on the show today, that is very large and was discovered apparently in 2014. So we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to get Lauren's thoughts on whether are we at a tipping point when it comes to searching for Bigfoot. How does he feel after all of these years? Obviously, there's a lot of new techniques that are being attempted. Jeff Meldrum, I believe, wants to fly a blimp over the forests with infrared, with FLIRs, and try to find Bigfoot that way. Obviously, various people have been attempting to do work with DNA. There are trail cams all over the place. So I'm going to ask Lauren if he feels that there is a chance that we are getting closer. Are we closing in here in 2014, or does he feel that today we are exactly as far away as we have always been when we're searching for some of these mysterious animals? So we're going to talk to him about that tonight, and so much more. Now, on that topic, last week on this program, we were talking about the discovery down in Florida of what people believed may have been a Sasquatch arm. they found an arm and a hand. It was a skeleton. It was clearly not a human arm, but it did appear to be something rather interesting. And it got people to thinking, well, what is it? Could it possibly be like a bear's arm? Is it possible that maybe some sort of primate, like a chimpanzee, someone's pet, had escaped and died, and that's what we're talking about here? Well, as it turns out, this from bigfootevidence.blogspot.com, turns out it is an alligator arm. And they have added in the headline a frowny face to indicate their disgruntlement. It says here that if you have listened to After Hours Radio, I guess, with a Richter Riolo, Stacey Brown Jr. revealed that this was actually an alligator's arm. Word has it that Brown was asked by authorities to turn in the arm, but Brown sent in a picture instead. Supposedly, there is a cult in Florida that has been going around skinning animals and forcing members to devour the flesh. We are not making this up, it adds. The Bigfoot community is pleased that the mystery arm has been properly examined. Tammy Murray of After Hours says, I'm happy it did not go on any longer. The facts were revealed by experts on animal anatomy. So there you go. Wasn't a Sasquatch arm. I would be interested in interviewing Stacey Brown Jr. and asking why, when the authorities told him to turn in the arm, instead of turning in the arm as requested by, as noted, the authorities, he supplied a photograph instead. I don't know how he got away with that, but apparently he did. So there you go. It is not, in fact, a Bigfoot arm. Also this from my local Seattle Times, which it notes here victoriously is the winner of 9 Pulitzer Prizes. This article from September 7th in local news, Bigfoot's local devotees have a belief that cannot be shaken. A story went worldwide this summer about a genetic study of 30 samples that supposedly came from Sasquatch, Yeti, or other humanoids. They actually came from bears, horses, and even cows. A good number of those samples came from Washington State because here, it says, we believe. When you are a Bigfoot believer in Washington State, for some the epicenter for the creature, you don't get discouraged, not even by this summer's scientific results that spark headlines like, DNA analysis indicates Bigfoot may be a big fake. Which, by the way, if you are doing a study and you request samples of hair that people believe are from a Bigfoot, and all of these people send this hair in, and you do the genetic testing, the DNA testing on all of the hair, and you find that none of these samples are Bigfoot hair. They are bears, they are raccoons, horses, whatever. How do you conclude that that means that Bigfoot must be hoaxed? All that means is nobody turned in anything that was from a Bigfoot. Now, if you don't believe in Bigfoot, great. But to be completely fair, just because 30 people thought they had Bigfoot hair and not a single one of them actually had Bigfoot hair, that alone does not prove that there is no such thing as Bigfoot. But apparently, headlines all over the country, newspapers and reporters came to that conclusion. DNA analysis indicates Bigfoot may be a big fake. It turned out that this region, the Seattle area, was a major contributor of hair samples to the study done at the University of Oxford. Hairs thought to come from the elusive being. Washingtonians sent in half of the 20-something samples from the U.S. There were a total of 57 samples worldwide from alleged Yetis and others, and 30 of them were found to be good enough to test. After 2 years of work, out came the results in July, published in the prestigious Proceedings of the Royal Society B, the B being for biological scientists. The hairs were from raccoons, horses, bears, cows, wolves, no unknown mammal. But try shaking the belief of Bigfoot believers. Not going to happen. Their stories are of having seen one, heard one, had one surreptitiously move around their campsites while they slept. They know it lives. Rettman Mullis here, a Bellevue psychologist who founded a site called Bigfootology.com, says, I have seen two of them, and I have had hundreds of interactions with them. I don't know what that means. I presume, what does that mean? You're doing wood knocks? Are you doing howls? What is an interaction with a Sasquatch? I need to interview this guy, actually. He's in my home. He could come to the studio, in fact. I'm going to have to try and set that up. If you are listening right now, Gareth, Rettman Mullis. Let's try to get him in studio for this show. He says a very rough estimation is that there are 100,000 Bigfoots in North America. You can understand, this article says, why the skeptics are skeptical. If there are 100,000, where is just one body? The search has spawned at numerous Bigfoot groups and the cable show Finding Bigfoot, where they're always on the verge of tracking down the creature, but never quite do it. And if that isn't an accurate description of that program, I don't know what is. But Mullis believes. He even helped collect samples for the Oxford study and is listed as its co-author. The primary author is Brian Sykes, 63, a professor of human genetics at Wolfson College in Oxford. With his main interest being human evolution, Sykes says he has always been curious about the Bigfoot stories. Sykes is well aware of the ridicule that Bigfoot enthusiasts face. He says, I am in the late stage of my career. I wouldn't have done this when I was young. Your colleagues will think you are a bit eccentric. The DNA analysis totaled $40,000, which Sykes paid for himself because he did not think it was appropriate to use public money for this kind of work. He says he is gambling. He can cover the expenses through a book that he's writing on the Yeti Enigma. He says he has always figured the odds of making a Bigfoot hair match at 5%, but he says even a 5% chance is a risk worth taking. He says that even though the test came back negative, all that means is that these particular hairs weren't from a Bigfoot, not that a Bigfoot does not exist. This Mullis fella says he remembers vividly what he saw at age 10 when he became a believer. It was in the summer of 1977, and he was on a family ferry outing in Puget Sound. He says he saw a massive creature, all black, literally four times the size of a regular man, his arms coming out of the water, swimming in the wake of the ferry. Now listen, I live here in the Puget Sound, and I go on ferries all the time. I don't know where this man was that he somehow saw a ferry swimming. I'm sorry, he saw a Bigfoot swimming in the wake of the ferry. I've got to get this guy on the show. When you see something like that, he says, it changes your life. He is telling the story at the Granite Falls home of Pearl Prihoda, 56, who works at the local school district in the kitchen and as a janitor. She is Bigfootology.com's official historian. She displays her beliefs to all with a 12-foot, 2,000-pound chainsaw carving of a Bigfoot in her front yard. And by the way, if you want to Google this, it's on the Seattle Times website. There is a picture here of Pearl Prihoda standing next to her life-size, it says, statue of Bigfoot. And unfortunately, it only shows the squatch from the waist up. And it appears Pearl is standing on the second rung from the top of a large ladder. Now, ladders are usually 6-7 feet tall. She's standing on top of it. So that would mean this Bigfoot would be about 12 feet tall, which I don't buy that as being life size. That seems a little large. But if you would like to check out this photograph, it is up there. She grew up in Granite Falls. And remembers when she was 16, she skipped school with her boyfriend, which of course is a no-no, and the two had driven on an old power line road and they parked. They caught sight of a nearly 8-foot creature walking through the woods. She says it was blackish charcoal, covered with hair, had these really long arms. It scared the daylights out of me. We tore out of there. She said she was hooked. There was no doubt in my mind that what I saw was absolutely real. Now, as somebody who at one time was also 16, if I were out with my girlfriend and we were hanging out in the woods, I would have had to see something to tear out of there terrified. So she believes this was real. We have the three main pillars, she says. We have cover, as in forests. We have plenty of water, creeks, rivers, and lakes. And we have plenty of food. They are omnivores. They eat berries and nuts. And they have farmland. They're constantly raiding farms. And they find cattle with hind legs ripped off. And they find cattle carcasses in the trees. Now, the newspaper here is exactly as skeptical as I was here, because I live in this area. I've never seen a cow carcass in a tree. I've never even heard of it. And I live in this area. My buddy Dave Gray, who I just had dinner with, he lives out there in Granite Falls. I've never heard him tell me about a cow in a tree. Well, Mullis says, mostly the media ignores these type of things. It certainly would be unusual for the media to ignore cattle carcasses in trees. There is an example here of a front page story from 1924 in this very newspaper, it says, the Seattle Times. Explorers on Mount St. Helens, which as you all know has since erupted, find a cabin with roof smashed by rocks said by prospectors to have been hurled by the mountain devils. Clues to gorilla men found maybe a lost race of giants, it says here, a lost race of giants. The Clallam Indians tell of 8-foot setiks, I don't know what that is, who killed game by hypnotism. I guess that's the native word for Bigfoot. They killed their prey with hypnotism, and their existence was kept secret by other tribes. Of course, this is in reference to the story that occurred at Ape Canyon. If you want to Google the story of Ape Canyon, it was a very famous story in Bigfoot lore. So there you go. That an article from the Seattle Times. And I got to say that I've been out with the BFRO, never seen anything. I have heard weird things around my house, but hey, listen, I live in Bothell. There are no Bigfoot where I live. But the point of this is, sometimes outside, I hear weird howls. Now, I don't know what they are, but my guess is, based on where I live, and the fact that it's really not all that wooded. I mean, we got woods around, but we're talking if you walked for 5 minutes, you could get through the woods and be on the other side. So it's not like there's dense, thick woods by where I live. But I do hear weird noises. And I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's an indication that many people, when they hear weird noises, they just presume it's Sasquatch. And it's really just, I don't know, a dog, cats mating. I don't know what it is. I once played some of my Bigfoot sounds here on the air. And actually, nobody gave me a good explanation for them. I would bet thousands of dollars that these are not true Bigfoot howls that I recorded. But they are very weird and they are unidentified. The best anyone came up with was they believed it was cats mating. And I got 3 cats. They don't mate. But I cannot believe that the sound that I heard could have come out of something the size of my cat. Because it sounded really weird. But in a moment, we're going to be joined by Lauren Coleman, and we're going to be talking more about that, cryptozoology in general, and all of those topics. Josh here on Twitter very quickly says, I have wondered, Brian, what is the most paranormal thing that has ever happened to you? There's never been anything that has happened to me that has just been like so weird that I will tell my grandchildren about it. I have seen weird lights in the sky, but I'm a skeptic. And I've always found some way to explain them. I remember when I was very little, I was at my grandfather's house. They had a trampoline out in the backyard. And I remember laying on the trampoline, and man, did I see something weird in the sky. It was like it looked like a soap bubble, but it was not a soap bubble because it was way, way up in the air and it was just traveling in a straight line. I had absolutely no idea what it was. I'm pretty sure my sister saw it as well. And that was the closest I've ever seen to something that it was like, I don't know what that is. It looks like nothing I've ever seen. That was very weird. I had one experience doing this show, actually, which is not really paranormal. It was just kind of creepy. I was all alone in this house, and I swear to you, I heard my wife, and she was not here. In fact, she was up volunteering on Friday Harbor, so she wasn't even within 100 miles of me. That was very strange, but really no other weird paranormal events. I mean, I've been around things that supposedly have been paranormal. I used to have the old jiu-jitsu school that we were at. Everybody insisted the place was haunted. They would hear things. One of the students even claimed that she had seen something, but I never saw anything. I never had any evidence that it was haunted. And also the where my grandfather lived in Idaho. My father claimed that he once slept downstairs in the basement, and not only did he have a night terror, but he had something sit on him when he was down there. And there was nobody there, and it freaked him out. So that's really the closest I've ever come to anything paranormal, but I'm still young. There's still time. Let's take one phone call. You are on the air. Who is this, and where are you calling from?
This is Nikki from California.
Oh, Mickey?
Nikki.
Nikki, what's going on?
Yes, I would like to talk about some paranormal things that high school that's near me that I investigated at, and I got a few EVPs that say my name. And it also says, one of them says, run away, actually, in like a whispering, like, the usual sounding type of EVP that a lot of people get.
So there was a school, let me just reiterate all this. There was a school near you that claimed to be haunted, and you took it upon yourself to do an investigation. Is that correct?
Yes, it was three of us, me, my friend, and my brother, and we went real late, like around 9, and we stayed until, I think, 1, and when we came back that night, we checked them, and we caught them automatically. I mean, they're just, like, if I were to play them for you, you wouldn't recognize them.
I would not recognize them.
I'm sorry. This is my first time calling. So
that's okay. That's okay. Well, why don't you tell me a little background? Like what? Okay. So the school was said to be haunted. What did people say about the school?
Well, there's a hall like an auditorium where that supposedly has some paranormal things happening sometimes. Sometimes shadow figures. I've heard that people actually have heard footsteps and such. And there's a big stage area with a balcony with seats, and on the floor there's seats. And supposedly, mostly people that are in performing arts that are practiced on the stage, if they're there real late or early in the morning, they'll see. They'll hear footsteps coming from the back of them in the back of the stage, and they know that they're the only ones that are in there because it's part of their class, so they have permission to be in there. Nobody else should be in there, so they know they're the only ones in there, and they began to hear footsteps, and sometimes people even hear like music being played. The national anthem, the school, like, anthem.
Sure.
That's been a part of the school for, like, years. Some people actually hear that coming from the auditorium. And I've actually heard a story about, in the auditorium, that a girl actually committed suicide off of a balcony, like, right in, like, next to offices. Like, right when you walk in, there's a top balcony that, stairs lead up to, and I guess he supposedly jumped off and died over, I think it was over like some boyfriend drama and stuff like that. But yeah, because it's so hard to get into that, because it's locked in, you really need like some connections or some permission to be able to get in there. And I'm not one to try to break in and just to do some paranormal investigation. But we did do a lot of things around the auditorium, and they also have a hill that's called the Goat Hill, and it was built on top of an old bomb shelter during like the Cold War, and but it also was built over an old Chinese cemetery, and on that hill is actually where we got all of our EVPs at, like that one specific place. No other place really that we were at. We got we didn't get any voices, only on that hill. And I'll probably have to call another time when you're doing more of a ghost like EVP talk to be able to play you.
Well, actually, if you can you send me like the audio files, because I can play those here on the air and probably sound better than doing it over the phone.
Oh yeah, that's perfect. How would I do that, go about doing that?
Just send them to brian@wrestlingobserver.com and just send them as mp3 attachments, and I'll be able to play them.
wrestlingobserver.com.
that's right, all one word, brian@wrestlingobserver.com, all one word. And it's up at afterdarkradioshow.com as well, if you want to go up there for the email.
Okay. Would it be better to email or just go through that website?
Either one works. Just email them to me. If you go to the website, you can get the email. So just email them to me, and then I can play them here on the air.
Okay, I'll do that then.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call, and send those to me, because we've got a guy coming up in a couple of weeks, actually, that's going to be talking ghosts and shadow people. So I'm very excited about that. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from California. Your grandmother mentioned something on the last show, which was sort of, I've been researching, because I think it's more or less she said something about the ice bucket challenge being satanic. The only thing, I looked into this because I laughed at it myself. Supposedly in certain witchcraft, in processes, whatever, in voodoo and such, if you're linking to an evil spirit, one of the last things you do is you cover your entire body in ice and water. Therefore, a lot of Christians have taken to YouTube and saying the ice bucket challenge is actually a satanic thing put out by the end of the New World Order and such and such and such.
You know, it's funny. When she mentioned that, I had no idea what she was talking about. And she said, I read it about it on the internet. And I was like, what is she talking about? She's out of her mind. So sure enough, just like you said, the next day I had people emailing me going, this is in fact a thing in hardcore Christian circles. They're talking about the ice bucket challenge being like a satanic ritual. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. What next?
They also claim there's something called the fire challenge, which is they link the fire and ice thing. And this one really does sound dangerous. Apparently there's kids who are coating parts of their body in a flammable liquid, and they'll stand in the shower and they'll light it on fire for a second to prove they're tough, then they'll put it out.
Yeah, I recommend against that one.
They're saying, yeah, I haven't heard of, and apparently they're actually, for a good reason, they're warning parents about that one, because you don't want to, you're actually burning yourself. But apparently they said the fire, there's fire and ice challenges going around. That one sounds more like a jackass stunt to me. But
yeah, I don't see that one catching on.
No, but that's what that's what I heard about that. And I don't buy it for us. Even if covering yourself in ice was part of a certain ritual in some occult practices, I don't see how this figures into that, but that's what they're claiming.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. I was trying to open up a page here, but it's doing that stupid auto audio, and I don't want to bother everybody with that. But it is interesting. I just since he mentioned it, I was reading today that there is a black mass event that a group of Satanists have arranged, and it is sold out. So tickets going fast, apparently. And they are set to stage an exorcism. So maybe I'll try and read a little bit more about that here in a bit. But It is time to join for Lauren Coleman to join us. Lauren Coleman is the man behind the International Cryptozoology Museum, which is quite amazing, actually. If you Google Lauren Coleman, everything you ever wanted to know about him is up there. But we are about to get him on the show. I've wanted Lauren Coleman on the show since, in fact, true story. When I first started After Dark Radio in, I believe it was 2011, I think that Lauren Coleman may have been the first guest that I tried to contact. And I was unable to get a hold of him, so I never got him on the show. But I've always wanted Lauren on the show. And my producer, Garrett, is so great. If you have ever listened to any of the guests on the show and you've thought like, oh my God, how did Brian get so-and-so on the show? What a great guest. I didn't get him on the show. Garrett got him on the show. And so a while ago, I was just thinking, okay, if anybody can get Lauren Coleman on the show, it's Garrett. And so I put him on it. And the next thing you know, he emails me back and he goes, Lauren's on the show Friday. So I was as happy as I could be. Lauren Coleman, legend of cryptozoology. So he is coming up here in just a moment. You're listening to After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Here on After Dark Radio, Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio and the Dark Matter Radio Network here every Friday night. Happy today, very happy today, to be joined by Lauren Coleman, who I would go as far as to say is a legend in this field. And Lauren, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a nice September day, and it's good to be talking to you.
Now, obviously, I think that because of the internet and the rise of the internet, there are a lot of young people today that may have just recently, like in the last few years, discovered Lauren Coleman. But you have been doing this for most of your adult life. I believe you first got interested in this in the 60s. Is that correct, when you were a little kid?
Actually, in 1960.
1960.
I was 12 years old. I had just seen a movie called Half Human, and I went to school the next day and asked my teachers, what was this about the abominable snowman? And they said, they don't exist. Leave me alone. Get back to your schoolwork. So I decided to get every book I could get on the subject. I started contacting game wardens and went out on expeditions with them to investigate Black Panther reports and smaller Bigfoot reports, giant snake reports. I started corresponding around the world with people like Bernard Heuvelmans and Jerome Clark and Mark Hall and Ivan Sanderson. And before I was, within a year, I had 400 correspondents around the world. I was doing all kinds of field work and continued it into throughout the 60s, decided to go to an anthropology, zoology undergraduate program in Illinois. And one thing led to another. And I mean, perhaps people haven't heard about me until recently, but I've been doing this for 54 years now.
That's right. You know, I think that in this field, and I'm sure you would agree, there are all sorts of different characters that are investigating cryptozoological beings and such. And there are some of them that are pretty out there. They are determined to believe. I don't want to say, I'm sure there's some that will fabricate evidence, but there are a lot that will take anything at face value. And what I like about your work is that you are, would you consider yourself kind of like a zoologist in the sense that you would like to really discover undiscovered animals? This is not about, you know, you hear a report and you're just going to spread the word about, you know, this sighting was here or there, but you really want to discover unknown animals.
Definitely. Cryptozoology to me is really about the study of hidden or unknown animals with the goal that we will find new species. It's not about, you know, getting my name on TV or writing the next book. To me, I really look at the field skeptically and open-mindedly and really weigh it in that area. The two kinds of people that I really am cautious about as far as going on an expedition with them or talking about them with their case are the debunkers who come into the situation with a mind already made up, and in the like-mannered way, the true believers, because the true believers will take anything in lock, stock, and barrel and really don't look at things with a critical eye. And I think as a scientist, we have to really not believe in these things because belief is about religion, but we have to really examine, investigate, and go all the way through, including saying such things as that's really not a good case, or I don't know, or it is the 1% of the cases that are hoaxes. And really grasp that situation very firmly so that we can say, we know what happened in that case. Let's go on to the next one, knowing that we did the best we could to get to the bottom of it.
I think that some people, when they hear about this sort of thing, and they hear about somebody who's interested in discovering Bigfoot and that sort of thing, an average person on the street might think, okay, well, this guy is, you know, he's a little bit out there. But for you, I mean, like any scientist, I mean, it's all about your credibility, correct? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, and if you are giving your name to some discovery, I mean, you're staking your reputation on this.
Right. I mean, I've been in the academic world. I've taught classes in documentary film and anthropology and social work, all kinds of different things. And even there, I can be very credible. I can stick to my guns and all of that. And still I can go to a faculty meeting and somebody will rush up to me when they hear I'm interested in cryptozoology. And they'll say silly things like, oh, you're the guy that chases little green men.
Sure.
So there's still going to be the ridicule factor, and I just don't let it sway me. I try to be like a willow. There's always going to be ridiculous people saying ridiculous things.
Now, the International Cryptozoology Museum, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, your logo, I believe that's the coelacanth on it, correct?
Exactly, the coelacanth, yes.
That's right. So for those that are unaware, I mean, this was a fish that was believed to have been extinct for, I presume, millions of years. It was a prehistoric fish. And
right.
it was discovered
65 million years.
65 million years. And it was discovered again in the 30s, correct?
Right. The local people knew about it, which is one of the tenets of cryptozoology, that the indigenous peoples, the natives, the locals usually know these things are going on. Western or Eastern scientists who really have a verification process for zoological species, they didn't know about the coelacanth. In 1938, a museum director at the East London, South Africa Museum came across the body of a coelacanth, which the body that she came across in a pile of fish at the dock from a trawler. This fish was 5.5 feet long and had bright blue skin on it. And she was very excited, and she wanted to take it back to her museum for mounting and study and everything like that. And so, unfortunately, she'd walked there, so she had to talk a taxi driver into put it in his back seat. She got that back to the museum. She started looking in her books and found very quickly that this fish exactly matched the fossil fish of a coelacanth, which nobody in science had seen for 65 million years. So it was a great discovery. Unfortunately, nobody could find another one until 1952. So the second coelacanth wasn't discovered until 52. And of course, in 52, the media absolutely went wild and had full page spreads of it. And a little known fact is the discovery and actual media sensation that created in 1953 caused the making of the movie Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Really?
Yes, because the whole notion was that if something could come back from 65 million years, at least that's the way popular media had it, like it had come back. of course, had been here all the time. But if something like that could happen, then the Gill Man from the ooze of the Amazon could come forth into your science fiction movie.
Now, did you choose the coelacanth because, in your opinion, it is the epitome of a rediscovered, thought-to-be-extinct species? Or is there something that you feel is really a bigger deal that has been discovered, but the coelacanth is such an iconic example of this that you chose to use that for the logo?
Well, definitely. I chose it for several reasons. It is a darling of cryptozoology. And a lot of the cryptozoological organizations have down through the years picked things like the giant panda or the okapi. The okapi is the giraffe-like animal with the stripes on the hindquarters that was discovered in the Congo. Those are very iconic symbols, too. But since we are in Portland, Maine, and we're on the coast, we thought that we would try to pick a darling of cryptozoology that was actually a marine animal, a coastal animal. And also, we started the museum in 2003, and actually, the coelacanth is a cryptozoological specimen and species that has kept on giving, because what occurred in 1998, 6,000 miles away from the African coast where the first one was discovered, there has been a whole new discovery of a population of coelacanth off of the coast of Indonesia. And so in 1998, that discovery was as big a deal, really, as the 1938 discovery.
Now, I think that some people have this impression that we've discovered it all. And obviously, that's not the case. There are new animals, thousands of new animals that are discovered every year, including primates. If you have any sort of general numbers, I mean, how many new species do we generally discover in a given year?
Well, we discover many. Most of them are very small. Of course, there's millions of insects that are discovered every year. There's smaller fish. The number that's best to talk about is within the last decade, there have been 400 new species discovered that are larger than a cat. And that's a pretty remarkable number when you think that everybody thinks that all of the large animals, all of the mammals, the reptiles have been discovered. That's really not true. And we look every year. I mean, there's things like a brand new species of bird was discovered in the Central Park in New York City. There was a new species of turtle discovered in the Pearl River in Mississippi within the last 2 years. But even if we look at animals larger than that, a small rhino-sized animal called a tapir, there's the animals with the little prehensile nose.
Mm-hmm.
We know about, before this year, we knew there were four species. A brand new species of this large animal was discovered this year in the Amazon, in the mountain areas of Amazon. And what's really surprising about this discovery of this brand new huge animal is that for 100 years, a mounted version of this, a mounted specimen of this new tapir, existed in the American Museum of Natural History, because 100 years ago, one was shot and put on display there, and nobody really looked in too deeply to see that this was a different tapir than all of the others that we knew about. In fact, the reason that it was shot and it became a celebrity at the museum was because of the person that shot it, not because of the animal. The person that shot it and put it there is a guy named Teddy Roosevelt. And so it became more important for the person that actually killed it and mounted it than for what it was at the time. But we now know brand new fifth species of tapir is a major discovery this year.
I live in Seattle, and it's summertime, and so I've taken a lot of trips around the Northwest. I went to Canada. I went to Idaho. Go down to the coast all the time, the Oregon coast. And when you really drive around, I mean, there is a lot of wilderness. I mean, a lot of wilderness. And obviously, when you're talking about something like Bigfoot, Sasquatch, I mean, you have that part of you that thinks, is it really possible that something 7 to 8 feet tall, maybe 500 pounds, and enough of them to sustain a population. I mean, is it really possible that those could still be undiscovered in 2014? And then sometimes when I drive around and I just see how much vast wilderness, and keep in mind, I'm not driving on a county road. I'm driving like on I-5 or something like that, or you know, a highway that's not all that remote. And I look at all of the wilderness around, and it's kind of like, there's a lot of room for something out there.
Brian, I think you really hit it on the nose there. Because what if you look at the Pacific Northwest, 80% of the land surface of the Pacific Northwest is covered in trees. Most of that is wilderness area where we're hearing the reports of Bigfoot and Sasquatch. We know such things as most of that area is inhabited by mountain lions and bear. Most people don't see mountain lions and bear, you know, just driving around. So if you consider a population of large primates that may be more likely 6.5 to 7 feet tall, 300 pounds, those exaggerated figures of up to 9 feet seem to be what happens whenever humans interact with new species. They make them more fantastic. They're more scary. They're monsters. Anyway, all of those known animals are in that area. People aren't running into them every day. And if you consider that maybe for every 1,000 or 10,000 black bear, there's only one Bigfoot, you're going to have less interactions, less encounters between humans and Bigfoot. And the other thing, of course, is that most humans don't really see what's around. I live here in the state of Maine, where we have 95% of the land surface is covered with trees, and people pass moose all the time that are right along the road, and they don't see them because these animals have a way of really hiding in plain sight, just like apparently Bigfoot does too.
You know, it's funny. I once my wife got me for my birthday an expedition with the Bigfoot Field Research Organization. And so I went out there for like 3 days, and we're way out in the middle of nowhere. And they've got all of the night vision goggles, everything like that, and we're just kind of looking around. And there was a moment where a group of us, probably 15 or 20 of us, were walking down this road in pitch blackness. And we passed a field where there were like 20 to 30 elk. And none of us would have had any idea they were there, except somebody happened to look over there with like a FLIR. Had it not been for the FLIR, we would have passed a herd of 20 elk and had no idea they were there. It was that was really eye-opening to me.
Yeah. And most people see bear only at dumps and crossing the roads. They don't see them deep in the wilderness. So the same thing happens with bear. The bear are all around, but they don't want to be seen either. So the elk didn't want to be seen. It had to be, you know, just a random person with equipment that most people don't have in the wilderness.
This is going to sound like a weird way to set up this question, but I've been reading a lot about low-carb dieting and how the body uses certain calories. And I was reading about, and this is true, I've determined this myself, If you put a giant gallon of ice cream in front of me and I'm hungry, I can devour that gallon of ice cream like it's nothing, and I'll be hungry a few hours later. But if you put a bunch of big steaks in front of me, I mean, how much steak could I really eat before I was satisfied and able to go about my days? It would be a lot less. It's like if you go to Olive Garden and they have the all-you-can-eat pasta bowl, you could eat a bunch of those. But they whenever they have the contest, it's like, if you can eat this giant burger in 30 minutes, you win this prize. And no one ever can finish the giant burger because it's all of this meat. And so I was thinking, how long could I subsist on one cow? And granted, I'm nowhere near 300-500 pounds. But when I really think about it, I could last a long time on one cow. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is when I hear people make the argument that there's not enough food out there to sustain a population of large Bigfoot, I kind of think if this is a meat-eating animal and given how much wildlife is out there in the woods, I mean, I would think that they could probably survive fairly easily on a few elk. I don't want to say per year. I don't know anything about this. But I would think that there would be enough food if that was your diet.
Well, for one thing, we're pretty certain from just watching them and recording this down through the years that they're omnivores. They've been seen catching fish in rivers. They've been seen eating berries, even raiding dumpsters. But I think that one of the secrets of the whole wilderness out there in the Pacific Northwest, it's not so much that they need to, you know, kill a big, you know, herbivore like a cow. They eat little things like pikas and marmots and grasshoppers, but they also eat one of the highest concentrations of protein that is around that is really unknown to most people, and that's pine nuts. Pine nuts have one of the highest concentrations of protein, and they could be eating pine nuts to get their protein if there's no meat easily accessible.
I have always been fascinated by the Patterson-Gimlin film. What are your thoughts on that film?
Well, I think that I think it's certainly the gold standard for having a good piece of evidence. And I often use the analogy that it's like pancaking. You have an area that has over 400 years of native traditions of Bigfoot-like creatures. You have a history among Californians, you know, going back to 1958 in the Bluff Creek area of having Bigfoot reports. You have two men that saw this creature. Their horses reacted to it. They took films of it. They got footprints of it. And indeed, if you look and analyze this film, it has compelling evidence that there was something real that was seen there. And most people don't even, it's one of those things where people look at that frame, that one where she's has her feet kind of separated and her arms going out. It's been imitated in a lot of other cartoons and T-shirts and everything. If you look at that carefully, you'll notice one thing that is often missed by people. If you look at her calf muscle, you can actually see it tightening up. If that was a costume, it would look more like a pant leg. It would not have that strict definition. The other thing in looking at the history of that time, carnivals, Hollywood, whatever, did not have the technology to make a suit that works so well. It has two independently moving breasts on that, you know, body there. And there is no suit that existed in the 60s like that. There has not been a suit that anybody's been able to make that can do that kind of movement or have the muscle movement underneath the hair and the fur. And indeed, if you look at what's happened with that film is the Zapruder film of cryptozoology. It's been studied, it's been analyzed, it's been stabilized, it's been enlarged, it's been, you know, frame by frame analysis, and so we're pretty certain. I mean, I would say I'm 95% certain that that's a real animal. I always leave myself a way out. So someday, maybe somebody will come forth that isn't, you know, is credible. I think every claim that's come forth so far has been very weak and full of holes and really not at all able to stand the test of time as much as the Patterson-Gimlin film has.
You know, one of the things that really convinced me was an article that I read where somebody had gone through and they had looked at every single either Sasquatch or Sasquatch-like creature, like a Chewbacca, for example, that had ever been used in a Hollywood film. It was Harry and the Hendersons and King Kong and Chewbacca and all of these, all of the Grinch, all of these giant hairy man-like creatures in Hollywood. And you think about the budgets of these films, and sometimes, like, you know, with the Grinch, that's the main character. That's what they're going to spend the most money on. And nobody in Hollywood has come even close to making a creature that looks as realistic as what is in the Patterson-Gimlin film, which was supposedly created by a couple of cowboys in the late 60s. It was a very eye-opening article to me. You would think that if this was just a suit, somebody somewhere with a lot of money should have been able to make a better suit.
Exactly. And even in, like, the BBC did a documentary about the Patterson-Gimlin film, and they had somebody create a suit and walk across to a creek bed to try to replicate the film, And they couldn't even do that with the budgets that they can throw at that. I mean, here they were, their whole purpose was to try to make a suit, a fake suit, to show that the Patterson-Gimlin film was a fake, and they couldn't do it because hair looks different, fake hair looks different, even dead hair looks different than living hair. And nobody, you're right, nobody in Hollywood, nobody in documentary production companies nowadays have been able to replicate what you see in the Patterson film.
I remember when Bob Hieronymus did the video where he put on a suit and did the walk. And because the walk looked so much like the Patterson-Gimlin walk, it convinced some people that this was the guy in the suit. But I remember watching and just thinking, that suit looks ridiculous. I don't buy that being right. A Sasquatch. I don't care how it walks. Look at the suit. It's ridiculous.
Right. And Hieronymus there had 35 years to practice the walk, too.
That's right.
So, you know, and we actually found pictures of him. He said he was in the suit when he was like 18 years old. And if you look back at the pictures of him when he was 18 years old, he was a beanpole basketball player, very tall and thin, and not even that tall, but, you know, thin. And so you look at him nowadays with the pot belly and the beer belly, whatever you want to call it. He looks more like the, Patty in the film. And so a lot of people did that association with this guy coming on, you know, TV telling us that he was in the film. Oh, that makes sense because he looks like it.
Sure.
He didn't look that way when he was, you know, 1967. So that's another piece that people forget to look into.
Now, the Patterson-Gimlin film you mentioned is the gold standard in terms of film. What would you say, in your opinion, if somebody came to you and they just said, what is your best evidence that Sasquatch exists? I mean, maybe there's some recent interesting DNA evidence or maybe just local populations talking about it and such. What is your best evidence that these exist?
Well, I think that if you look at footprints and you look at hair samples, all of the hair samples that have come forth so far have been found to be human, raccoon, bear. There are no good hair samples that really give us too much information. There are some older ones when the DNA was tested, and the DNA testing wasn't that good back then. And, of course, what happens whenever you test hair is you destroy it. So it would be wonderful to have some of those samples, but unfortunately, different testing has actually destroyed some of the evidence. But looking at the footprints, once again, I think you have to look at Grays Harbor, Washington State, 1982, where some police officers were involved, in which a Bigfoot crossed the road in front of their squad car, and there was a little bit of mud on top of asphalt. It actually created some footprints that has a very distinctive toe reaction. If you actually think of yourself without any shoes on, barefoot on the beach, whenever you put your foot into wet sand and then pull it up and you get that sucking noise and that sucking sound, well, it looks like Bigfoot in that case in 1982 in Grays Harbor actually had created a similar situation because the casts that are from that time have something very distinctive about the toes. It's called the mushrooming effect, and that's very hard to hoax. So if you have a side view of their toes, they actually look like a mushroom cloud from the atomic explosion or a mushroom indeed, because that's what happens. You put in the toe, bring it out, you leave a little bit of impression, but actually the passage out gets narrow because it collapses in. Very, very hard to hoax. That's extremely good piece of evidence. And then I would return to the Patterson-Gimlin film, because the Patterson-Gimlin film has such an enormous body of evidence connected to it, including footprints, 10 footprints in a row, all of which have been cast. What unfortunately happened in the 60s and at the beginning of the Bigfoot days, you would have a long line of footprints, and the people would look for the most perfect footprint to cast. Well, we know nowadays that it's much, much better to find a footprint that's not perfect, because that shows the living foot of a Bigfoot. So luckily in 1967, when all 10 footprints were taken, you can actually see how the foot moved. And that wouldn't be a hoax foot because it wouldn't have been a rigid, you know, mold or model to squash into the mud or the creek bed. It actually was a foot that was moving around and would buckle up a little if a stone was under it and things like that. So I still would return to the Patterson-Gimlin film is the best piece of film for Bigfoot.
Jeff Mel-
piece of overall evidence, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, Jeff Meldrum obviously has tons of casts. And him and many others, they always point to the footprints. I mean, I think that a lot of people would presume, well, you know, footprints are easy to fake. You just make a cast or you make a fake wooden foot, and then you kind of stomp around a little bit and you fool people. But the things that, that are found in these footprints, I mean, these are very, I mean, I guess you can't rule out beyond a shadow of a doubt that maybe somebody faked these footprints, but the amount of detail, and sometimes I'll read a story about, you know, these guys are out in the middle of nowhere and they find tracks that they follow for 3 miles. And it's like, you're telling me that some guy went out in the middle of nowhere and for the fun of it, he did 3 miles worth of tracks, hoping that somebody might just be in that exact same area before they all vanished. It kind of, I struggle to believe that.
Right, right. And the other thing is, we're pretty, you know, Jeff Meldrum, even Grover Krantz, the late Grover Krantz before him, myself, and a lot of field workers and people that are involved in this, they know their tracks pretty well. They have a lot of good woodcraft. And the hoaxers come along, and they make little mistakes that they kind of casually forget about, such as in the very famous hoaxer Ray Wallace, who was died in 2002 up in your area there, and his kids found the wooden fakes in his garage, and then they brought him out, and they said he was the father of Bigfoot. Well, Ray Wallace, the carvings that he used, all of the toes were always more square than round, and humans, Bigfoot, and other primates don't have square toes in the footprints. We have ovals and round toes, and those were little giveaways that anybody that looked at Ray Wallace's foot cast and footprints certainly could see they were fake.
It's funny you mention that, because it reminds me of when those two guys in I think it was England, came out and talked about how they made crop circles. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, there's the press announces that they are responsible for every single crop circle. And I was like, there have been crop circles all over the world for thousands of years. How? It's ridiculous. And same thing with Ray Wallace. Like, they find a couple of wooden footprints, and all of a sudden, he's responsible for every Bigfoot footprint in the world.
I know. It was, I actually did a whole study and then an article about how Ray Wallace's story comes out, and I showed how it traveled across the United States, skipped over to England, and then was picked up again by the L.A. newspapers. And by the time it had come back, besides Ray Wallace being responsible for all of the prints in the world, in the Bigfoot world, he also was claimed to be the one that made the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Wow.
It was just amazing to see how crazy the media can get to try to explain away the whole Bigfoot field.
It's like a game of telephone.
No, exactly. It was. It's an amazing thing that you can see happening in the media sometimes.
Now, recently, there have been some new ideas to try to discover Bigfoot. It looks like we're really on the Bigfoot topic here today. I know Jeff Meldrum wants to do a fundraiser to, I guess, get a blimp with infrared that will fly over forests. I think that, is that his idea?
Yes, he was trying to get a blimp called Aurora. But he actually recently announced in just the last couple of days that he has a mysterious benefactor who has given him $250,000.
Wow.
To retrofit 3 drones. So he's going from the blimp idea to the drone idea. And so I think he's all okay with his funding now. And he's going to go forward with using drones.
And obviously, there's also people working on DNA evidence. And I haven't followed this close enough, so you can fill me in. But there was the deal where they did some testing on supposed Yeti DNA. And while it was not a Yeti, allegedly it was a polar bear, I believe, that was thought to be extinct. Is that correct?
That's a good summary of it. Dr. Brian Sykes from Oxford University asked for Yeti, Bigfoot, Amas, hair from all over the world. He got about 50 samples in, and of those 50 samples, a little over 30 were good enough to extract DNA from them. Every one of the Bigfoot samples from the United States turned out to be known animals, such as raccoon, black bear, moose, even there was a human hair in there. And so, you know, that sort of was what was kind of expected because it's very hard to find Bigfoot hair. And actually what had happened right before his study, a woman who is a veterinarian in Texas had asked for samples, and she got over 120 samples. And there is some kind of, let's say, just real sadness in the field that she depleted the samples by getting her collection.
I see.
So the guy that had much more credibility, Dr. Brian Sykes, is actually world famous for being the person to have extracted DNA from fossils and written the first papers in that area. Anyway, to go to the Yeti samples, there were three Yeti hairs that he felt he could be tested. One was actually from our museum, from Sir Edmund Hillary's 1960 expedition, and we were pretty confident we knew what that was going to come back at, as, and it indeed did. It came back as sarrow hair, which is a little goat antelope found in the Himalayas. And the dark secret with Sir Edmund Hillary's expedition in 1960 is he actually went over to the Himalayas to debunk the Yeti. And so he seemed to have gathered different materials that actually reinforced his notion that there was no Yeti there.
Mm.
But the two hair samples that you're talking about that were really, actually this is where the media also misinformed the public, where they would have headlines that would say, Yeti's been discovered, it's a bear, and things like that. What Brian Sykes found was that he had two samples separated by about 600 miles from each other at each ends of the Himalaya. And they also were separated by 40 years. There were 40 years between the collection of them. And he found 100% DNA match between those hair samples and the DNA that had been extracted from a Pleistocene extinct bear, Pleistocene 40,000 years ago from Norway. And what they found, this kind of bear that the mandible jawbone had come from, was a brown bear that was transitioning and evolving into the polar bears. Because, of course, polar bears really did evolve from brown bears. And both of those hair samples actually were of brown hairs. So what Sykes feels has happened is there's a relic population of bears, an unknown species of bears, undiscovered in the Himalayas that is getting reported by some people as a Yeti. Among the native peoples, they've always talked about three kinds of Yeti. The very small Yeti, which is in many ways related to the hobbit, the Homo frensis, that was discovered in 2003.
Talking very small, like 3.5 feet tall?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And the Orang Pendek in Indonesia, different creatures like that. The man-sized Yeti, which is also called the Metel, and the Metel seems to be an orangutan, but sort of that size. And then the larger giant Yeti, also called the Denzate, and that has always been considered to be some kind of bear. So a lot of us cryptozoologists were not at all surprised that he finally confirmed that one of the Yetis was a bear. What has really surprised all of us and really excited people on this side of the media is that this would be a brand new species of prehistoric bear that nobody thought was around anymore. That would be as exciting a discovery as a coelacanth.
Discovered in 2014.
Yes, yes.
And much bigger than a coelacanth.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I'm looking forward. He's got a new book coming out this fall, and he's actually talking about going on a little expedition to try to find more evidence of this prehistoric bear. So all of those are exciting developments in cryptozoology.
Now, do you feel, I mean, here in America, obviously, as noted, all of the hair samples came up negative for anything resembling a Bigfoot, all known animals. And do you feel at this point in 2014, I mean, on one hand, it is 2014 and we have no definitive evidence. And when you looked at all those hair samples, there was still no definitive evidence. But on the other hand, I mean, we are going further into DNA testing. There was the polar bear. There is the drone experiment going on. Do you feel in your gut that we are closing in on something? Or do you have that feeling that it is possible that these drones will turn up nothing? We've still got no DNA. We're just as far as we've ever been.
I feel like we're opening many new doors. When I was in the university in the 60s, what I noticed is that none of the academics, none of the professors really were open-minded about it. But now to have people inside the universities who are open to DNA testing, who are open to talking about Bigfoot, and some people like Jeff Meldrum and others who are actually teaching about Bigfoot, that means that I think the more doors that are open makes it more possible that more people are looking. I wish Jeff Meldrum all the luck in the world. I'm a friend of his. I am somewhat dubious about the drones because drones can only get so far into a deep rainforest. And I've certainly been up to Bellingham. You know, I've been into the Olympic Forest up in your area.
Oh, yeah.
And it gets to be very dark and deep there. I can't imagine a drone flying overhead would necessarily see a Bigfoot. I'm hopeful, but still then what happens? You see it by drone, and then you try to get 20 miles inland on your Land Rover to try to catch up with what the drone saw half an hour ago. You know, I mean, I think we really need to think about just putting some people in the field and have them live deep in the forest for like 6 months at a time.
Yes.
And to try to have the Bigfoot come to them.
When did you first formulate the idea of an international cryptozoology museum?
Well, it was formed and founded in 2003. In the preceding 3 years, I really thought that it was time to, I mean, my collection, of course, 50—that was 10 years ago. So 45 years of collecting materials. I've been to every state in the United States. I've been, around the world, Mexico, Canada. You know, did a Loch Ness Monster expedition in 99. So I collected things and sent things by different people. And an incident happened to me that really pushed me over the edge. I decided many years ago to start writing obituaries of cryptozoologists because I figured a lot of cryptozoologists' works were being forgotten because, the rock stars, the criminals, the politicians, they get obituaries written. You have somebody that dedicates their life to looking for Bigfoot and they're either seen to be a crackpot or a fringe person. I mean, but you have a Grover Krantz, you have a Jeff Meldrum, you have a lot of people, common folks, amateurs, and academics who need obituaries written. Well, I was in the midst of doing some more research, and I got a call from the brother of a person who had gone to Africa looking for Mokilia Mbembe, which is a dinosaur-like creature over there.
Like a brontosaurus.
And, this individual had died very young at 43, and his brother said, Lauren, I know you write very good obituaries. Would you mind doing one on my brother? And so I said, of course. You know, he'd just been out to visit me the Paul before, and I knew this individual quite well. I wrote an obituary, and 2 days later, his mother called me up and said, "Oh, that was wonderful. That was just outstanding. You're so, you know, nice in dedicating such a tribute to my son." And she ended her conversation by saying, "Oh, by the way, you don't need to worry about his files. We threw him in a dumpster so nobody'd have to worry about him."
Oh,
and that just,
man.
That went to the core of what I'd been thinking, is that the history of cryptozoology was being lost. The people that aren't directly in the field, even parents, even loved ones, oftentimes get rid of collections. And it's almost like the mythical story of the mother that throws away all of the baseball cards. You know, it really does happen. And so I really opened the museum for educational, scientific, and natural history reasons to dedicate it to the history of cryptozoology and cryptozoologists to share with the general public, and not necessarily so that everybody in the world would send us all of their collections or all of their artifacts from their expeditions, but so it would serve as a model that people would give it to their alumni, they would give it to their local historical society, some way to start capturing the history of cryptozoology. And then in 2011, we became a nonprofit, a 501c3, so that we could really continue this after I'm not here anymore. I wanted to make sure that it became a legacy and became a natural history museum in cryptozoology that would last even beyond my death. And I've been very, very happy. It's soared in terms of recognition. We were on the top 10 list of weird museums in the world in Time magazine last May. And we've been on CNN and MSNBC list. And we were on CBS Sport Sunday morning. You know, so it's getting recognition for the serious educational museum that really is, and not just a fringe museum. Even though I understand and really appreciate, like Roswell, I'm glad that somebody did that for UFOs, that there's a, or Mothman, or the Bigfoot Museum that's in Willow Creek, California. I'm glad that people are doing these around the country and around the world. But we right now are the only general cryptozoology museum in the world. And I'm very proud that I got that started.
Now, is it true that it started out in your house?
Yes, very definitely. I bought a house in 2003 that was larger than what I needed. I was divorced and had two teenage sons. Well, they weren't quite teenagers then. And we did not, the whole first floor became the museum. And I would have Animal X and, you know, all kinds of different documentary film companies come here, do interviews about cryptozoology, use the artifacts from the museum, and I would have visitors and other scientists and cryptozoologists come and visit me. And then after a while, the museum just outgrew the house, and we needed to make it more public. My sons became pre-teenagers to teenagers, and it just didn't work anymore for us just to live upstairs. And the collection, by now, in Portland, we have 10,000 artifacts in the museum, and it's just grown and grown and grown. And we certainly, probably in 2 years, are going to move to a space that has to be twice as large as what we have now.
And so we'll say that again. So in 2 years, you think you're going to need double the space you have now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're in the midst of a five-year lease, and we have to come to some real head-scratching time in 2016, and we're definitely going to move. And we have certain plans in place, and you know, we're kind of keeping them close to our chest because we want to surprise everybody. But I think the surprise will be a very welcome one.
Wow, that's awesome! Now for those that if someone is traveling in the area, tell everybody a little bit about what are some of the coolest things for you personally that you have collected in the museum?
Well, we have a 8-foot-tall, 500-pound Bigfoot that was taxidermically created by a taxidermist in Wisconsin, and it's actually covered with 2 muskoxen fur, and a bison hump is the top notch. So it's a very accurate Bigfoot as far as size and the hair length and everything. The one thing that I don't like about it, but I can't change, is that it has a beard. And this Bigfoot was created in 1990, and the taxidermist actually used Harry, a more serious version of Harry from Harry and the Henderson, as a model. But I may have a beard, and a lot of men, human men, have beards, but beards among Bigfoot really don't exist that much.
It's funny you mention that, because I'm looking at it right now, and the beard is a much lighter color than the rest of the Bigfoot. And as a result, I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but it kind of looks like you.
I know some people have said that, but that wasn't intentional. I actually got the Bigfoot, as soon as we created the museum, and I had tried to get it about 5 years before I obtained it, but it was being sold for $10,000 on eBay, and I just don't have that kind of money. And what happened was 4 years later, the owner hadn't sold it, and he called me up and he said, you know, I really, really want this in your museum. Is there any way that you could afford to give me anything? And so I actually was crashing my retirement to do a down payment on this house that turned into the first museum. And I gave him a little money, and then he gave me free shipping and paid $500 to ship it out here from Wisconsin.
My God.
So luckily it was made before I became into the picture, but it actually has now been at the museum longer than where it was before. But we also have a guy named Lee Murphy who does models for Hollywood. He did and donated in 2009, when we moved to another site downtown Portland, a 14-foot-long model of the sea serpent, the juvenile sea serpent that was found off the coast of British Columbia in the stomach of a sperm whale in the 1930s. We also have the United States' only model from the 1938 coelacanth. So we have that in the museum too. That's 5.5 feet long, life-size version of the coelacanth. We have the Civil War pterodactyl that you can find online, was floated around for over 6 months by a television production company before they did the series Freaky Links on TV. And they act like it was a real photograph from the Civil War. It wasn't. It was this giant model of a pterodactyl. We actually have the only movie version. It's the actual movie prop from the movie P.T. Barnum of the Fiji mermaid, 3.5 feet tall. And so we've got a lot of large things like that, but we also have a man named Tom Page, Ohio millionaire, who sponsored actually Roger Patterson and Peter Byrne expeditions in the 1960 to look for Bigfoot. He donated his whole collection to us just this June, including the actual dart gun that those folks took out to shoot Bigfoot and try to tranquilize Bigfoot.
Wow.
So we have things like that. Jeff Meldrum, of course, has the most casts in the country, but we have upwards of 150 different Bigfoot casts, and as well as Yeti casts, Yowie from Australia casts, and a true giant from Russia cast, Orang Pendek. So we have casts and hair samples. Like I mentioned earlier, we have the hair samples from Sir Edmund Hillary's Yeti expedition, as well as fecal material and hair samples from Tom Slick's 1959 Yeti expedition. So the museum is just filled with those kinds of things, but also, hats or boots or different things that people have used on expeditions, and they've donated those. John Keel donated part of his files by his estate after he died. We're getting to be a repository for some pretty important collections that are kept off exhibit. And then occasionally we bring different letters or different samples of those collections on collection. So we actually change the displays pretty regularly, highlight different things. We have, for instance, one of the parts of the screen that the Boggy Creek Monster pushed its hand through. And so there's little mementos. You have to look close, and we have descriptors of them. Makelia Mbembe, Jersey Devil, the first Montauk Monster replica, Mothman material. I consulted to the Mothman movie, so got some of those things in there. It's a great collection. I'm very, very proud of it.
Now, unfortunately, we're running low on time, so I got to get two other questions in here before we start doing some plugs here at the end. But since you mentioned both of these things, number one, did the alleged Thunderbird photo, the real one, ever exist?
We don't know. Ivan Sanderson certainly said he saw it, and everybody's looked for it, including me, and we haven't found it yet. So I can't say if it exists or not. They remember it.
Yeah, that's my question. Do you remember it?
No, I never claimed to have seen it, and I don't remember it.
It's really funny, because when I was younger, when I first heard the story, I remembering having seen it.
Uh-huh.
But as I get older, I don't remember having seen it anymore. It's really weird. And maybe it's just because I've read so much about it.
Right, but do you remember where your car keys are?
I put them in the same place, so thankfully.
That's good. But I think that's what you speak to is, as we all get older, those memories of our memories are fading too.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny because every now and then on the show, I'll mention the Thunderbird photo. And invariably, somebody will find one of the various pictures on the internet and they'll go, Brian, it's right here. And they'll send it to me. And the funny thing is, none of them, first off, I know I've seen all of them before. That's number one. But none of them that I've ever sent is the one that I think I remember seeing, if that makes sense. It's really weird to me. But I've always been fascinated with that story because it felt like something that I had seen before. But
the general memory is that it's a bunch of men with it tacked to a barn door or the side of a building.
And standing with their arms out, right?
Right, and there it is, a feathered creature, not a pterodactyl or reptilian creature.
Man, just drives me crazy, that story. And the other one is, tell me more. My wife runs a nonprofit involving whales. And so the sperm whale and the sea serpent. I need to know more about this story.
Well, it's what occurred was that there was at an area that's right off the coast of British Columbia. It was actually a whale station. They brought in these whales, and they oftentimes would cut them open, as you may know, and they would find usually squid inside. Well, they cut this one whale open, and then they found this long reptilian or serpent-like creature inside. They put it up on top of some crates, took pictures of that, and people would talk about that for years, and once again, they could never find the picture. And then in 1992, different scientists searching through old archives actually found the picture.
Wow.
So we have a picture of that, and it's on a lot of different websites. You can pretty easily find it. It's the carcass, and it's from, I believe it's 1936, which is about the time, of course, of the coelacanth discovery, too. So quite exciting. And so then the models there, the pictures there, and this individual made an actual three-dimensional model, life-size, for the museum.
You know, there's a famous picture of a supposed sea serpent that I guess was trawled up or whatever by a Japanese fisherman, and it looks for all the world like a plesiosaur, but it's decomposed,
shark.
Right?
It's a basking shark.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, actually, on that ship, that same period of time, they tested it, and it came back basking shark, and then it got back to Japan, and that was kind of lost in translation and became a plesiosaur and became sensationalized.
I see. Now, when you have seen the photo, and obviously you've got the replica, I mean, does anybody have any theories about what this thing is? I mean, is it presumed that whatever it is, it's real and it's out there? We just haven't found it.
Yes. I mean, there's lots of the scientists that discovered it, LeBlanc and some other folks, they've theorized that it's a juvenile reptile, some kind of sea serpent that hasn't been discovered. A lot of us think that it's probably some kind of elongated whale and more ancient whale. And then the debunkers have come along and they look at the head and they say, well, that's nothing more than an immature moose. But it's too long, and the bone structure that you can see through the decomposing body certainly doesn't look like a moose to any of us.
You've written a lot of books, and if there was, let's say that people listening right now are heading up to Amazon.com, and they're going to buy a Lauren Coleman book, is there any book in particular? I believe Mysterious America was the first one you wrote, correct?
Mysterious America was the first one I wrote by myself.
Okay.
Jerry Clark and I wrote The Unidentified, and then we wrote Creatures of the Outer Edge in 1975 and 1978. In 1983, I wrote Mysterious America. Jerry and I revisited each other after independently doing many books, and the general book that a lot of people like is Cryptozoology A to Z. That came out in 1999 and is still in print. I think it's about 15th printing. The book that I really highly recommend to a lot of people interested in Bigfoot is Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America, and also My Field Guide to Bigfoot. Either one of those are really good. And then I also have a book called The Field Guide to Lake Monsters and Sea Serpents. So those collection of books really oftentimes people get. And a lot of people, young people who haven't read Mysterious America really are enjoying rediscovering it.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, how are you feeling physically these days? I know you had some health issues.
Yeah, I was hospitalized 3 times and a couple major operations because for whatever reason, my colon, my appendix, and my bladder all decided to fuse.
Oh.
And my system was dumping E. coli into other parts of the body. So I had an infection that nobody could track down for about 2 years. But I feel more healthy. They took part of my colon out, my appendix out, no cancer at all. Just all kind of inside stuff. And I feel really young, really healthy, and am enjoying food in a way that I never could before. And, you know, I don't know if you know it, but hospitals are the best fat farms. I lost 50 pounds without trying.
Wow.
It was a great time. Not a great time.
Exactly.
On this side of it, it's a great time now.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to hear that because I didn't know what happened, but whenever I read about it, it was always, Lauren Coleman's in grave condition. And when I read grave condition, it was like, oh, this does not sound good. But I'm glad
It was kind of touch and go, especially with some of the things the doctors did to bring my blood pressure down to 60 over 30.
Ooh.
That was not good.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I want to finish up today by getting some plugs in. Obviously, this is a 501c3, and as I have learned from helping my wife, she's in the process of becoming a 501c3. So this is, A, it's not easy, and B, when you're a nonprofit, there is a lot of work to be done in terms of fundraising. And so,
oh, certainly.
Yes, yeah. I want to give you an opportunity to talk all about where people can help, where they can donate, where they can go for information on you, the museum, books, etc. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, one of the easiest ways to access the museum and information about it is to go to cryptozoologymuseum, all one word, .com, cryptozoologymuseum.com. And our website is very clear on where we're at and how to access, even to buy souvenirs from the museum online, t-shirts, but also we have a donate button there. And you can go to the donate button and find different ways and different things that you can send. We also do encourage people who are in the field and leaving the field or getting old or, you know, unfortunately having chronic diseases or even thinking about a will, to put us in their will and give us, you know, give us some material to keep their legacy alive, because we very much appreciate some of the people that have gone before us and have been our mentors, and the museum is turning into a great home for those people. We also, Jeff Meldrum is getting together a an actual conference on relic hominids in Africa. And so we're separately fundraising for that to send myself and my assistant director to Africa. You know, the old bucket list thing. It's kind of a joke, but it's true. I'm getting up there in years, and I need to go to Africa before I die. And what better way than to go to a cryptozoology conference on hominids to Africa. So we're trying to fundraise, and a lot of people are interested in cryptozoology, and some of those people have money, and it would be great to have a little bit more donations to the museum. Our first few years, we lived month to month, and it's great now to be a 501c3 and actually build up a little two-month you know, window of opportunity, so we don't have to feel like we might close any day.
That is,
thank you for that.
Yeah, that is cryptozoologymuseum.com, and because it is a 501c3, these are all tax-deductible donations.
Tax-deductible, corporations, individuals. We give you a letter, and you can take it off your taxes.
And as far as your personal website, books, and that sort of deal?
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. Actually, you can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and type in Lauren Coleman. Unfortunately, there's another guy that lives in Seattle named Lauren L. Coleman that writes science fiction books, and we have the same publisher sometimes.
Oh, boy.
But he writes science fiction. I write nonfiction. I also have laurencoleman.com, and I'm still writing my blog at cryptozoonews.com, and so people can find me a wide variety of ways. I'm certainly not invisible. And honestly, I'm on Twitter at Crypto Lauren, so people can follow me by Twitter, too.
And the blog's a lot of fun, cryptozoonews.com. As you noted earlier, you do a lot of bios of cryptozoologists who have passed away. In fact,
right.
The first two stories right now are bios of people that have passed away. And it's fun, too, because every now and then there will be like, for example, down here, there's a new mystery cat photo. And not only can you see the photo, but there is an update where the mystery has been solved. So, yeah, a lot of cool things up there at cryptozoonews.com. And, Lauren, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I've wanted to do this interview for a long, long time. I'm glad we finally got a chance to set it up, and there's so much to talk about, and hopefully we can have you back on again someday.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's always fun to talk to you.
And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. Back in just a moment, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Back here on After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Radio Network, here every Friday night, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. Brian Alvarez here. That was Lauren Coleman of, well, about 9,000 books. I read a few of them before. Actually, I was looking through my Kindle, and I was like, what's the most recent Lauren Coleman book that I read? And I was going through I've got the iPad with the Kindle app, and I was going through there, and I was like, I've got a lot of this guy's books. So a lot of fun, and as noted, we only scratched the surface. I think that Lauren is good for doing long interviews, and unfortunately, given the amount of time we have on this show, we only have about an hour for our guests, but hopefully he will be back soon, because I didn't even get a chance to talk to him about the Loch Ness Monster, and we did talk briefly about the sea serpent, and I wanted to know more about this sperm whale that had eaten a sea monster, because my wife is a whale expert. And every time I see something in the news about whales, I send it to her. And she always says, seen it. So I'm always trying to scoop my wife. Like, can I find the story that she has not heard about yet? And I have not done so. But she, I sent her the link to the pictures, and she looked at them, and within 3 seconds had just texted back, terrible quality photos. And she had another explanation as well. I think she actually has heard about this. She, what did she say it was? She actually had an explanation for what they believe it is. If I can find it here. I don't believe that I can. Anyway, the point of this is she, here it is. Photos are horrible, she says. Let's see. I'm wasting everybody's time. Oh, here it is. ID is a fetal baleen whale. So not only had she seen it and I didn't scoop her, but she thinks that she knows what it is. A fetal baleen whale. That is her official diagnosis. So I thought I should bring that up. Also, she sent me this while we were on the air. This from likes.com. It says here, 13-foot, and by the way, she scooped me on After Dark Radio because I hadn't seen this either. 13-foot-long horned sea monster found at the beach leaves scientists baffled. The remains of a mysterious, bizarre sea creature found on a Spanish beach has left experts baffled. The 4-meter-long creature, with what appears to be horns, was found decomposing on Luis Sire Beach in Villarricos, Spain, leaving locals wondering if they had caught a glimpse of a mythical sea monster from the deep, Grind TV reports. A lady found one, and we helped her retrieve the rest, Maria Sanchez of Civil Protection in Cuevas said. We have no idea what it was. It really stank. Experts and residents are struggling to determine what the remains are, with guesses ranging from everything from a relative of the Loch Ness Monster, a dinosaur, a sea monster, or an oarfish. Those are apparently the latest sea monster reports and the latest possible IDs in oarfish. So check that out. Eric here on Twitter says, what if Bigfoot is a time traveler or an interdimensional traveler? What would that mean for the rest of us? Well, what that would mean is that something went wrong somewhere, that Bigfoot discovered time travel before we did. It might explain why he has never been found. Last week, we talked about the mysterious cell phone towers. And we've got an update here. This is a WND.com exclusive. Now, to be honest with everybody here, hopefully somebody on Twitter can alert me very quickly. I am on the website. It says WND.com. There is a logo that says WND. And I have absolutely no idea what Oh, it's WorldNet Daily. That's what it is. I got it. I apologize, everybody. WND exclusive. Security experts weigh in on mystery cell phone towers. There has been an uproar this week following a popular science report that revealed the existence of more than a dozen cell phone type towers across the U.S. for which no owner could be located or operator identified. Business Insider reported that towers appear to be connecting to nearby phones, bypassing their encryption and either tapping calls or reading texts. The report said the fake communication towers are undetectable for most telephone users, but a new and pricey product called a crypto phone confirmed a number of bogus cell towers. As for those who run and own the towers, Les Goldsmith, an expert in phone technology, said it just is not known. What we find suspicious is that a lot of these interceptors are right on top of military bases, so we begin to wonder, are some of them U.S. government interceptors? Are some of them Chinese interceptors? Whose interceptor is it? Who are they that is listening to calls around military bases? If it is just the U.S. military, or perhaps are there foreign governments doing it? The point is, we don't really know what they are. My question is this. If I were the government, and I had a base, and very close by, there was a cell phone tower that could not be identified, that appeared to be connecting to nearby phones, bypassing their encryption and either tapping calls or reading texts. And I could not determine who the owner was. The owner could not be located, nor could the operator be identified. I would bulldoze that thing so fast you wouldn't even know what happened. You're telling me that these have been discovered by military bases. Nobody knows who they are. They may be, it says here, Chinese. And the government is just leaving them there to tap phones? I would be very skeptical of this story. So I would presume that the U.S. government is probably responsible for these strange towers. But I do not know. This very interesting from the Mail Online, the dailymail.co.uk. World exclusive. Jack the Ripper unmasked how amateur sleuth used DNA breakthrough to identify Britain's most notorious criminal 126 years after a string of terrible murders. DNA evidence on a shawl found at Ripper murder scene nails the killer, it said. By testing descendants of victim and suspect, identifications were made. Jack the Ripper has been identified as Polish-born Aaron Kosminski. Kosminski was a suspect when the Ripper murders took place in 1888. He was a hairdresser, and Kosminski lived in Whitechapel and was later put in an asylum. It says it is the greatest murder mystery of all time, a puzzle that has perplexed criminologists for more than a century and spawned books, films, and myriad theories ranging from the plausibility to the utterly bizarre. But now, thanks to modern forensic science, the Mail on Sunday can exclusively reveal the true identity of Jack the Ripper, the serial killer responsible for at least five grisly murders in Whitechapel in East London during the autumn of 1888. DNA evidence has now shown beyond reasonable doubt which one of six key suspects commonly cited in connection with the Ripper's reign of terror was the actual killer, and we reveal his identity. A shawl found by the body of Catherine Edowis, one of the Ripper's victims, has been analyzed and found to contain DNA from her blood, as well as DNA from the killer. The landmark discovery was made after businessman Russell Edwards, 48, bought the shawl at auction and enlisted the help of a doctor, a world-renowned expert in analyzing genetic evidence from historical crime scenes. They used cutting-edge technology to extract 126-year-old DNA from the material, and they compared it to DNA from descendants of Edowis and the suspect, which both proved a perfect match. So there you go. The claim that DNA evidence proves that Jack the Ripper was Polish-born hairdresser Aaron Kosminski, who was, in fact, a suspect in the Ripper murders, which took place in 1888. I should mention that during the interview with Lauren Coleman, I received an email. Actually, before I get to that, what is this? I have got a photograph in front of me from the mirror.co.uk of a sea monster. It is a picture of what for all the world looks like a brontosaurus. And it is an Art Bell classic in the sense that I'm going to tweet this out right now. It's so baffling. Hold on one second. Loch Ness Monster? All right, go to my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. You can see this picture right now. Yeah, this looks for all the world like a brontosaurus. And it is an Art Bell classic in the sense that it looks way too good to be true. Which, of course, is the old joke. I mean, if you take a photograph of the Loch Ness Monster and it looks just like a blur, everybody goes, why are they always blurry? Where is the real picture of the monster? You're telling me there's a monster and nobody has ever taken a clear photograph? And of course, when a photo like this turns up, which is clear as can be, what's everybody going to say? Well, you know, it must be Photoshop. And I got to admit, when I look at this picture, I presume it's got to be Photoshop because that is way too clear a photograph. It looks just like a classic brontosaurus. So if you want to check it out, at Brian Alvarez, you can head up there and check the photo. We got a couple minutes left. If you'd like to tell me what you think it is, I presume most people would just say Photoshop. But if you'd like to let me know, you know what to do, Twitter. Anyway, as I was saying before, I was distracted by that photo of a brontosaurus here in 2014. During the Lauren Coleman interview, what did I receive in my email box? But an email from Nick, who was the fella who called in about the EVPs in a high school in Fresno, California. And I have four files here. Now, as they say in the entertainment business, everybody, you always got to leave them wanting more. So I'm not going to play them this week. But within the next couple of weeks, I have got a guest on who's going to talk about ghosts, and they're going to talk about shadow people. Somebody had called and asked about shadow people, and suffice to say, I am not an expert on shadow people. And so I am going to get a guest on. We're going to talk about shadow people. And on that show, I'm going to play these EVPs. He says here, the first one, you can hear a voice sort of sing the name Nikki, which is my name. No, this is not Nikki Bella for you wrestling fans. Second one, you can hear my brother ask, was that you laughing? And right after that, you hear a faint nope or yup. He's not sure. Third one, my brother is speaking in the beginning. And afterwards, he says, can you say something? And you hear a spooky voice say, run away, as if they were out of breath. And fourth, part of the same EVP session that we caught Runaway. And on the last EVP, my brother says, can you say something? And on this clip, you can hear a whispered voice say something. Perhaps it was a late response to my brother's question. These will be played in coming weeks on After Dark Radio. Dazza here says, it's a gag, claiming that Nessie has deserted Scotland if they vote for independence. Well, there you go. I actually should have known that because somebody sent a shout out the other day regarding this this deal with Scotland. So I should have figured that out. It started as a joke as we Scots are voting on our independence this week. Nessie will leave Scotland if you do. I'll read that shout out on the Tuesday Brian and Vinny show, everybody. I don't know what they're trying to do, but they're trying to get me to take sides. So I don't even know if I should read the shout out. I don't want to get in trouble by anybody, but anyway, we are out of time. I want to thank you all for listening to the show today. A huge thank you to Lauren Coleman for coming on to the show. As always, you can head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Everything you ever wanted to know about this program is up there, including replays every week. And of course, if you don't want to head up and grab the replay, don't worry. Tomorrow on the Dark Matter Radio Network, the show will be replaying all day. So head up there and check that out. Always support the Dark Matter Radio Network. There is so much great product up there, absolutely free, on the Dark Matter Radio Network. There's shows all day tomorrow, all day Sunday, all day, every day, all week long. Of course, ArtBell.com, the place to go for everything reported on the Dark Matter Radio Network. A giant thank you to our webmaster, Keith Rowland. Of course, everybody involved in the show, Andrew on the Facebook page, Garrett, our booker, and everybody else as well. The great Art Bell, a huge thank you to him. Hopefully, sometime in the next year, he will return. And until then, everybody, I want to thank you so much for listening. Back in a week, After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.